As we're looking, 17 weeks. 17 weeks, Jody decides now to let me know I made a grammatical error. No one's noticed it. You know, like it could have just went over. I could have been done with the study and I could have easily went back and corrected it. No, I'm just kidding. But there's several ways I could have corrected the phrase on the slide, but I didn't. I'll fix those. So we are studying the biblical timeline of Jesus's resurrection week. We're studying the biblical timeline of the resurrection of Jesus. We're studying the biblical timeline for the resurrection of Jesus. All different ways you could take that sentence. But in our last study, we were looking at Jesus as he's on the cross. We of course looked at how he arrived on Mount Calvary, Golgotha's hill, right? We looked at last week. We spent considerable time on the statement he makes to, and I believe it's in Luke's gospel, to the one of the two criminals, how you'll be with me in paradise. We spent some time on that. If you have questions about it, you can ask those after class or go back to last week's study. As we move on, and as we're still in the midst of what's going on the cross, another thing we notice is the dividing up of Jesus' clothing among the soldiers. And I noted this is one of the ways the soldiers were actually paid by the Roman government. They were allowed to take these things. That's when that phrase, casting lots, for his clothing, it was sort of, you might think of like a dice game that they would play. And however, if you won, you got your first pick, second pick, and so on. And so they would do this. Now, why does the gospel spend time on this, though? Why does the gospel spend time telling us that information? That is really what's important for us. Well, the reason they do it is to answer prophecy, right? This is something that was prophesied. If you go back to Psalm 22, verse 18, as the psalmist is writing about the coming Christ and what he would go through, he notes, Psalm 22, 18, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots, which is a direct fulfillment. Now, why is that significant to note? It may seem to some that that's kind of insignificant. Why even talk about that? Why does the gospel bring it up? You think about why?
Because how long ago it was prophesied? I mean, that couldn't have just been a coincidence.
Okay. Yeah, so for those who maybe doubt Jesus and what he did, this is a way to prove that he is who he said he was. Because how is Jesus, who's hanging on the cross, going to have any control over soldiers casting lot over his clothing? Right? And again, think about the time frame. Now, I don't know when Psalm 22 was written. I believe it was written by David. So David's how long before the New Testament?
10 centuries.
What's that?
10 centuries.
Yeah, so he's like 1,000 years before. I mean, that's a long period of time, and yet this prophecy was laid out perfectly. That's exactly what happened. And so, just kind of interesting.
It also demonstrates that Jesus dying was not an accident or some choice by man. It was foretold that he would, in fact, suffer this death.
And not some afterthought. Right, it wasn't some plan B, but this was God's plan that he set in motion long before Jesus ever came. Okay, any other comments about that? All right, we'll get livened up as we go on. Right. One other thought about this is what is kind of an intimate moment. You go to John. In John's Gospel, John 19, Jesus is hanging on the cross. Now, who is there surrounding him? Who do we know about from the Gospels? Who do we know was there while he hung?
John.
Okay. What did you say?
The centurion.
The centurion, right? The soldiers.
Herod was there.
So you have You mentioned John. We know John was there. John, the only disciple we know that was there.
Mary.
We had Mary. So we got a couple different Marys, don't
Mary's
we?
Mother.
So we've got Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, Mary the son of James and Joseph, and then Salome. I have trouble getting that.
Salome. Mary? Was that the wife of Cleophas?
No. Salome is the mother of what two disciples? James
John.
And John.
Yeah, John.
James and John's mother, Salome. And does he also mention the wife of Clopas? That might be the other Mary. So we know there's several women there with John. So they're there. They're close enough. This is kind of interesting. So we may have this image at the cross as this gigantic beam coming out of the earth. That's probably just not the case. He probably wasn't very far off the ground physically. We know he's close enough for them to communicate with one another. And so they're standing there. Can you imagine that as a mother? What that would have been like? I was thinking about that today, and what we're getting ready to talk about, it changed just a little bit of the way I look at this. Let's read it. Let's go to John 19. So let's go down to verse 25. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now there's other accounts that give you Salome as well. John doesn't mention that here. Maybe she's left at this point. Maybe she's come and gone. Or maybe she hasn't arrived yet. But you have those ladies. They're standing around. John's there as well. We know that by the interaction. And you can probably get into the mind here how difficult this is. Number one, for Jesus, of course, but for his mother and what that must have been like. Well, verse 26, when Jesus saw, notice that, when he saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home. Now, I've always just kind of thought about, well, from here on out, you know, John's going to have care of her. And I think it's true, obviously. But I think there's something a little more tender going on here. You may disagree with me, but that phrase, he took her that very hour, it almost says to me, Jesus is basically saying, John, take her away. That she doesn't need to be here for this. And what we know is later lists that come later, she's never mentioned. And it seems as though she is gone. And that just really touched my heart. I was just thinking about that. You know, here's the Son of God, God in the flesh, who has so many cares and concerns on his shoulder. On top of that, all of the physical hurt, the emotional and psychological damage that's been done. And yet in this moment, he looks and sees his mother and he has a real emotional response. And he cares about his mom and he wants to make sure she's cared for. I mean, that's natural, isn't it? Now, what we want for our parents, we want them cared for. And here is Jesus doing the same. I just, you know, such a tender moment in my mind. Yes, ma'am.
Did you ever wonder where his father was in all of this?
So, when's the last time we hear about Joseph? When he's 12. The Gospels never mention him again. Now, there's a lot of, like, ideas, but as far as I know, there is not one piece of evidence that says what happened to him. Now, a lot of people have surmised that he's probably died. But we don't know that. I think that was something that later on the Catholic Church began to teach. But I don't know of one piece of evidence that says definitively what happened to him. He's not around. I know that.
He's not here.
No. Now, did he leave on his own? Did he pass away? I don't know. And I almost kind of don't want to surmise too much about it, because there is really nothing that I'm aware of. Now, if somebody knows something, please let me know, but I've never heard of one piece of evidence.
This is also a fulfillment of prophecy made back in Luke 2, when Simon told Mary that, he says, a sword shall pierce through your own soul.
Wow, yeah, I hadn't thought about that passage. You put that with this, I mean...
I didn't know what he said.
Luke 2, can you say...
chapter 2, verses 35.
Luke 2, 35. What does the text say there? Luke 2, 35. Somebody read that real nice and loud.
Yea, a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed.
Yeah. I mean, that's a powerful statement that Simon is giving to Mary, right? And you think about all that. I mean, he's enduring all this directly. She is indirectly suffering through all of this. So, I think a really powerful moment. Any other questions or comments about it? All right. Let's move on. So, we're still Friday. Remember what part of the day are we in? We're in the day portion. Now, what I want to do in this next section is we're going to kind of put together a timeline of the events up through his death. Real quickly, it's not real lengthy, so don't get worried. But just put some times with this. So, as we read in the text, we know that Jesus eventually dies on the cross. And it's interesting, Matthew and Mark are very similar. I mean, very similar text. But I want to go to Matthew, and Matthew gives us a little bit more. So I want to read Matthew's account, and then we'll look at the other text for a little bit. But let's read this together. Matthew 27, let's go to verse 45. Matthew 27:45. Now from the sixth hour, so how many hours has he been on the cross so far? 3 hours. All right, so we'll look at that a little bit more in depth in a minute, but it's been about 3 hours. Now from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. So from the sixth to the ninth, that's from noon, our time, to 3 p.m., there's darkness over the land. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Direct quote from Psalm 22, I believe. Is it 22 or 24? And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, this man is calling for Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. But the other said, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth shook, and the rocks were split. The tombs were also opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. There were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. All right, so that's Matthew's account of those events surrounding his actual death. Kind of fascinating when you start to look at it here in depth. Now, when we look at the time frame we're looking at, when you first look at it, I'm going to go ahead and tell you this, you may be confused. When you compare the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, to John, you may be confused. I'll show you why. If you go to John's gospel, John 19, let's see. John 19:13. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at the place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover, so Friday. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." What's the problem? Initially, just looking at it, can you see an issue? Or a possible issue?
The sixth hour.
Okay, then why is that a problem?
Because in the sixth hour back here, he's already
on the cross, and it was already halfway through the time frame. All right, so how do you explain that? I'm not going to leave it. We're going to look at how you explain it. So, is there a conflict? No. And we'll talk about why. So, let's talk just for a second, a real brief review. The Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were written about when? So you're looking at somewhere between the 40s and the 60s for them. So right in that time frame, they're written. However, John was written when?
About the 90s.
In the 90s, right? So you got a pretty huge chunk of time. Who is Matthew written to? Well, we said it, right? The Jews. Mark was written to who? The Romans. And Luke was written to who? The Gentiles. At the time those three Gospels were all written, what was still standing in Jerusalem? The temple. When was it destroyed? AD 70. They were all written in those final decades before the destruction of Jerusalem. You also have Christianity coming out of a Judaic system, right? So when Matthew, Mark, and Luke were writing their Gospels, what kind of time frame are they writing on? We've talked a lot about it. What kind of time frame?
Jewish.
On a Greek-style, Roman-style Jewish time, sorry, or a Jewish style, right? Where their day begins at 6 p.m. and ends on the next 6 p.m., so evening and morning. That's the way they did their days. John, however, was written after the destruction of Jerusalem. He's also writing to a very different audience, isn't he? Who's he writing to? Who's John writing to?
First century Christians,
right? You're going into the second century, almost. And he's writing as a defense of what? Of Christ to a much broader audience. John wrote not on a Jewish, remember Judaism lost its temple and its basically its identity in AD 70. He's 20 years past that. You're living in a what world? Politically, culturally. A Roman world. He's writing on Roman time. That's our time. That should make it easier. When you come to John, he's writing on your time. The time you understand. So, in John 19, when he says the sixth hour, what hour is John talking about?
6 o'clock in the morning.
6 a.m., right? 6 a.m. That's when a lot of us are going to work, right? We live on that time. So, when he says 6 hours, he's not talking about noon, he's talking about 6 a.m. So, So according to John, when did the day for Jesus really begin? At 6 a.m. Now that's interesting, because being at 6 a.m., how long do we have between the beginning of his mockery trial before Pilate until he's actually headed to the cross? We've got 3 hours. Plenty of time to do all the things that we've studied, right? You with me? So we've got that 3-hour window. What takes place in there, just real quickly?
The scourging.
Okay, we have the scourging. That comes near the end, right? But we have...
The mock trial.
We have all the series of mock trial, or these trials, right? He goes before Pilate, then he goes before Herod, then he comes back to Pilate. You know, right?
Judas kills himself.
What's that?
Judas kills himself. Oh.
Judas kills himself during all this time. Right? He's scourged, and then he has the cross put on him. He's led to Mount Calvary. All that happens within this 3-hour window. Questions about that? Now, he's crucified approximately at 9 a.m. At 9 a.m. How do we know that? Well, let's look. If we go to Mark's account, go to Mark 15. Let me give you a verse here. Is it what verse? 20. Yeah. So, 25. Notice this is in the context of leading up the hill to the cross. Verse 25 says, and it was the what? Third hour. Now, again, Mark's written on what time frame?
Jewish
time. So, what time is that? 9 a.m. So, Mark clearly denotes that the actual crucifixion began at 9 a.m. All right, so that's when he's actually, approximately 9 a.m. is when he's hung on the cross. All right. So, another interesting thing to denote in our time frame is also you have two different events occurring. You have a 3-hour period of light, normal light, which is from 9 to noon. You have normal daylight. But as we've already read in Matthew 27, what happens at the 6th hour?
Darkness.
And that darkness lasts for how long?
3 hours.
Till the 9th hour. So from the 6th to the 9th hour, there's darkness. How do you know this is not a simple eclipse? That this has to be something more than an eclipse that would occur today.
The longest total eclipse could possibly be is like 7 minutes.
Yeah.
Or 9 minutes.
And this is 3 hours.
And this is like, you know, once every, usually they're like 4 minutes.
Yeah, so they're very short. Even the very longest of them, you're not getting anywhere close to 3 hours. So this is a intervention of God. That's all my only point here. This is an intervention by God. It's like the day the earth stood still. And God made the earth stand still for, 24 hours? And then one time for Hezekiah, he made the time go backwards. Right? This is one of those times when there's a supernatural intervention. And there's several other things that let you know God's really involved here. But that's one of them. So you have a 3-hour period of darkness. Somebody have a hand up? Okay, I didn't want to skip anybody. So you've got 3 hours of light, 3 hours of darkness. Just interesting. What would those symbolize?
Light is left.
The light is left. We're in the final moments. These are the final 3 hours of the physical life of Jesus. Significant event. All right. So, and then about 3 p.m., Jesus dies. And that's when he finally breathes his last. If you go back, go back to the text here. go back to Matthew 27. What's going on is you have verse 46, Matthew 27, 46. He cries out. He makes two statements, and I'm going to show you both of them. Matthew only has one. What's the first statement he makes? He gives a quotation from Psalm 22, doesn't he?
Why have you forsaken my God, my God? Why have you forsaken me?
He's crying out to God, why have you forsaken me? Many have supposed that, that this is the time period when God maybe turned his back on him. I don't know if that's what it is or if it's just... I don't know. But he gives us that quotation that's written, again, thousands of years, a thousand plus years before his time. And he cries out. Now...
Isaiah 53 says God laid our sins upon him. So at some point in that crucifixion, he became our sin offering, which would have separated him from God because God can't be around sin.
And that's what many have led, that this is the time that God could not look at him. Pretty significant, right? It's after he makes that statement that the soldiers... They hear, I'm assuming Eli, that person's very similar to Elijah, and they think he's calling for Elijah. Of course, that's not what he's doing. And then they give him that dirty sponge to drink sour wine out of. There's a lot more information about that dirty sponge, but where it came from, what it was used for. It's really gross. They give him the wine. And then it says in verse 48, verse 50, he cries out again. Now, what was that second statement? Luke actually maybe gives us that. If you go to Luke's gospel, Luke 23, and if you go down to verse 46, now, Luke does not give us the quote from Psalm 22, but he gives us another statement of Jesus. Luke 23, 46, what does he say? Then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. And so it's at that moment that his spirit leaves his body. Now, there's a lot of passages. I didn't really get into this in the study or in the plan to, but, you know, physical death, what occurs in physical death? You have this breaking, right? Death means separation, literally. And so you have this separation between soul and spirit, or between body and spirit, and the spirit. Where does spirit go? Solomon answers that, doesn't he, in Ecclesiastes? It goes back to the one who gave it. The body returns to the earth.
In John's account, it says that right before he dies, it is finished.
Oh, yeah, and that's another statement, John, yeah.
Yeah, John 19 says it is finished. That's what, when I read that, I was like, John 19, 30 says it is finished.
Yeah, so he's got those three statements. I'm sorry, I should have said three. Here he says, God, into your hands I commit my spirit. Oh, for... And I don't know the exact order, right? I just know these three final statements. The first one, or the one in Matthew's, is Eli, Eli. You know, he's calling out to God, why have you forsaken me? And then in Luke, he mentions that he also said, into your hands I commit my spirit. And then in John's, his final statement, John, is, it is finished. And so with those statements, he breathes his last. And his soul separates from his body. Where does it go? Refer back to last week's study. It goes on to paradise. There's where the other guy will go eventually as well. All right, so and that all occurs about 3 p.m. Any other questions or comments about that?
That would almost seem like a contradiction in a way, because in verse 46 it says, Father, into thine hands I commend my spirit. And having said this, he gave up the ghost. But then John 19:30 says, it is finished. And then he bowed his head and gave up the ghost.
So I wouldn't take that as a contradiction because, and I'll tell you why I know it's not, is let's say we all witnessed a crime occurring and we all had visual eyewitness accounts. Would all of our accounts line up?
No.
Would we all remember the exact same thing? Would that make it? Would we then be lying if we disagree, or if we remember different information? No. It's just because of one account brings out this statement, and he may be doing it for a certain purpose, doesn't mean that he is in opposition to the other one. There's no reason to believe that they all couldn't have occurred right there in those final moments, in my mind.
Perspective of what mm-hmm. Jesus was doing at his death. It is finished, refers to the old law and the sacrifice necessary for the forgiveness of sins. Mm-hmm. Commanding your spirit back to God, that's just a man surrendering his life.
Yeah. Good question. Any others? Everybody's thinking about it. All right, so he at this point passes on. Let me make sure there's something else I'm going to cover here. If you go back to Matthew before we get into the rest, there are a couple of series of events that occur right in the moment surrounding his death. God does some things. We noted the darkness for 3 hours. If you go back to Matthew's account, you notice a couple other things that happen, some pretty significant things. One of the big things that's noted is the tearing of the curtain in the temple. What curtain is being torn?
The veil of the temple.
Separation between the holy place from the most holy place. That curtain that only the high priest was allowed to enter on one day a year. That curtain that separated the most holy place from the mercy seat where God's presence sat. That was torn. Also, the Gospels are very particular in the way it was torn. What does it say?
Top to bottom.
From top to bottom. What do you think that probably signifies, or what that may that signify?
Complete.
Complete.
Well, God tore it as opposed to man. Yeah. Man would have tore it from the bottom up, mm-hmm. God tears it from the top down.
Yeah. I think there's significance to that, right? Top down. This is God tearing it down.
Can you imagine what the high priest would have thought on that day when the curtain was ripped like that?
Yeah.
Their whole world would have been cratered.
Yeah,
I mean, it represents some things. God's presence has left the mercy seat. Right? He can't be there. It also represents an opening, doesn't it?
Access.
Yeah.
Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 tells us we do not have a high priest, right, that cannot sympathize with all of our weaknesses, but in all points tempted, was he tempted as we are, yet without sin? Because of that, verse 16 says what? Let us therefore enter with confidence. Enter before the throne of grace with confidence. What's that throne of grace? It's the mercy seat. And so now I don't need a high priest, a human high priest, to go in before God for me. I have the high priest go in before God. He laid down a sacrifice they couldn't, the perfect sacrifice. And because of that, now I can approach God on my own. I don't have to have a mediator, a human mediator. I have a holy mediator in heaven. And so... that's so very powerful to me.
Well, Hebrews says that he entered through the veil, which is his flesh.
Yeah.
Jesus entered through the veil into the most holy place, but the veil was his death.
Mm-hmm. So you have the veil, the curtain torn in the temple. You also have the raising of, and it's particular again here, he's not saying just anybody, but he specifies who's being raised.
The saints.
The saints. Now, obviously, these aren't Christians. We don't have any Christians yet. But who would these people be?
John
faithful under the law.
It might have been John the Baptist, right? Who else? Yeah. That was a crazy day. Can you imagine coming out of the shop and seeing that and running back in? And it says, what were they doing? Matthew says, and coming out of the tombs, this is Matthew 27:53. After his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many.
That's it.
Let's see. Is it just Matthew? I think it's just Matthew that records that. Yeah. So Matthew's the one that we're left with on this. So we have those events. Those are obviously Holy Spirit, God moving, right? God doing supernatural things. And it got people's attention, didn't it? It's interesting to see the soldiers, their change in attitude. When he's crying out, quoting Psalm 22, what's their response? Let's see who comes to save him. And then after all those things happen, what's their statement?
Truly, this was the Son of God.
Truly, this was the Son of God. I'd love to know what happened to them after that. I hope that wasn't wasted. I hope that stuck with them, and maybe at least one of them was a changed person afterwards who really searched after God. I don't never have any word that change happened, but I really hope. I mean, I have a hope it did. But they do make that statement of faith, at least that small amount of faith. This truly was the Son of God.
I wonder what happened to the saints that have been walking around.
Yeah.
Oh, they died again. I know that much.
And how did they come back?
Did they go to paradise?
They were called out of paradise, weren't they? Yeah. They had to leave paradise for a little bit.
Didn't it say they came out of the ground?
Yeah, they came out of the tombs in their body form, but where was their spirit?
In paradise.
It was in Hades, Sheol, right? And they had to repossess their bodies. Now, what kind of body was that? Think about that.
Yeah.
Was it a fully kind of remanufactured body, you know, renewed body, or was it skeletons?
Zombies.
I don't know.
The
people recognized
who
they were.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah. And that's why I assume it's probably they're back in bodily form. That's kind of interesting when we get later after Jesus' resurrection. We're going to talk about that a little bit, about what kind of body did he have. But just fascinating. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but they're out there and people are like, what is going on?
Another thing that really would be interesting is what happened, how did the people in paradise respond to Jesus coming to paradise?
Yeah. We have so very little about that. We have a little bit, but not very much. Maybe he just rested. And I really want to talk about that in a minute. Well, we don't have time today. Neil honking the horn on me. Great questions. I guess I'll just let it go there. Just trying to make sure it wasn't something else. Well, the only other thing, and I'll stop here, is in John's Gospel, John lets us know what did the high priest and the council want from Pilate. Well, it's the day of preparation. It's the day for a high Sabbath, because it's not only a normal, normal Sabbath had special significance, but it's the Sabbath of what?
Passover.
So it really had a high significance. So what did they not want to be dealing with?
The people
on the cross.
On the cross, right. They needed them to deal with those guys on the cross. And so they asked for them to break the legs so that they'll die quicker. Really brutal. When you think about that, that is brutal. What that implies. However, when they get to Jesus, what does he know? He's already dead. And that's when he takes the spear and does what? Spears his side. And that's when the blood and water run out.
All right. His being dead probably was from all the beatings and scourging and abuse he had taken prior to going to the cross. Those other guys didn't have that problem to a degree. They were scourged, I'm sure, but not like Jesus was. Mm-hmm.
But he said that he's not going to suffer broken legs, mm-hmm. so he had to decease before they came around.
I'm out of time, so.
Yes, sir.
We'll get into the rest of this next week. We're going to talk about his burial and the events that surround that leading up to the Sabbath day. Thank you again so much. You'll be dismissed and rejoin for our devotional in just a second.